Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Brave. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your head.
Robert Hisrich with us. He is the professor of global entrepreneurship and director of the Walker Center for Global Entrepreneurship at Thunderbird. He's the co-author of Corporate Entrepreneurship, How to Create a Thriving Entrepreneurial Spirit Throughout Your Company. Robert, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with entrepreneurship today, that word holds so much water compared to what it was 10, 12, 15 years ago. Since the major corporations had to go head-to-head with their global counterparts and the competition that we couldn't deal with and all of the outsourcing, people had to go out in business for themselves and they became entrepreneurs. And I think in this day and age, to have something that will allow them to get their hands held and say, step by step, this is what to look for, is critical, Robert.
Yeah, I sure do agree with you, Michael Ray. Today, more than any other time, corporations really have to embrace this entrepreneurial spirit, which all of them had at their beginning because that's how they got started. And then as they grew and set up bureaucratic procedures and reporting systems, which indeed is essential as corporations grow, they lost some of that that excitement and culture that once was theirs. And with the rapidly changing technology and shorter product life cycles and new market opportunities with the emerging markets coming about, and then as you so nicely put, this hyper competition, I think it's just essential today for companies to grasp this concept.
Now, by the way, the word opportunity, Robert, is a very strong word, and part of your talking points, which I think is critical, is identify, evaluate, and fund venture opportunities. But the point is what do you know, how do you know whether a venture opportunity is really a good fit for you and what you have to offer also? I think that's critically important, and most people don't know. They look at the dollar value that possibly they could make, and they don't realize that this may not be the right fit.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, corporate cultures, and when you set up programs like this and sort of encourage people to be innovative and creative and not only in coming up with new products and services, which is the ultimate, but even just looking at your own job and saying, you know, how can it be better and perform more efficiently and therefore better for the company in the long run, you have to set up parameters for that in terms of the focal area of the company. If you allow people to go outside of that, then, of course, you do have the opportunity to divest that and either fund it yourself and take a minority position in that company, as many do, or just let it go and either say let the people take the idea and leave, or else, you know, just tell them that they're going to have to focus on something which is in our core mission statement. So you're absolutely right. You can't. This is not like entrepreneurship outside a corporate entity. You do have the entity to deal with.
No, absolutely. And there's another thing to take into consideration also when you talk about the impact on the organization's bottom line. One of the most important things, the critical thing within any organization, whether it be small or large, and I've seen this happen time and again, I've spent time back and forth in my life doing consulting, et cetera, from one time or another, and it never seemed to fail. I would walk into a business and I would sit down with the CEO, CFO, whoever was going to be that lead for the business in and of itself. And I'd say, okay, write down what your direct subordinate, vice president, senior manager, whomever, write down what their job is. What are they supposed to do? And they would write it down and they would get on, you know, very cleaned up, and they'd have it set in such a way that we knew exactly what that person was supposed to do. And then I would walk into that person's office and sit down and say, okay, give me a breakdown. What do you do? What's your job? 9 out of 10 times, Robert, it wasn't the same thing. And I think when we talk about having a fit, realistically, you can invest the smartest money in the world, but if it's not the right culture, if it's not the right fit, you could be in big trouble.
You're absolutely right. That's a great scenario you just said, and I totally agree with you. The disconnect between the levels in management in most corporations is just really appalling in terms of that they don't even know what other people do. I think one of the greatest things I've learned in doing this with companies and helping them establish this process and this whole thinking, which I think it's as much of a thinking and a culture as anything else, is what your real goal is to have people really, I call it own your job, and that's sort of a phrase of my own, where you really love to come to work. And if anything I'd like in the companies I work with or the companies I actually have started, is you really want to come to work because you love your job and you want your job to be performed the most effective and efficiently as possible. And this allows you to, self-actualize yourself. And, of course, the company benefits greatly from that.
You know, a great example of this, and I keep forgetting his name. Did you see the movie About Schmidt? That was with...
I did not see that, no.
Oh, whatever his name is. 4 o'clock in the morning, we'll call you and remember the name, Robert. But About Schmidt was about somebody who had been a CEO, been a manager, and been, you know, very powerful in his position in the business. Then he retired. Then he had nothing. No. And then he had absolute... We're coming up with the name. It'll come. But it... Who? Jack Nicholson. That's who it was. All right, Jack.
Oh, okay, yes.
And he was that manager. He was in that business. And when he retired, there was nothing there. He was lost. He didn't have anything to identify with. And I think one of the most important things, and to say it another way than what you've just said, is if I'm going to be in a business, if you really want my loyalty, you want me to get up in the morning and be excited about coming in, I have to become part of it. I have to have an identity in there. I have to have acceptance, and the business also has to be about me, quote unquote, in my facet of what I do. So one of the most important things is to create identity. Identity also gets you acceptance. That in and of itself is power in a business.
I totally agree with you. And what happens in companies that have this kind of thing, they really have the people have a feeling of self-achievement. They have job satisfaction. And they just feel that they can contribute to and have identity in it. And you can do that a lot of different ways, you know, through company newsletters and through very small reward programs or even large reward programs. And, you know, we just, particularly in America today versus perhaps 30 years ago, we just don't take the time to do that as much. We're all about efficiency and output and things of that nature. So you're absolutely right on that.
Now, the other thing you just said were large reward programs. You know, this is big battle going on now politically of anybody who's got rewards, you know, tax them, do this, do that. But I think in and of itself, when you're dealing with the way this country has, you know, has risen through our own workforces, our own, you know, our own corporate entities and so on and so forth, it's not everybody that comes in off the street that can make the kind of decisions that some of these people make to be able to expand the businesses and hire more people. So I am absolutely for major rewards. You do the job, you get the major reward, and everybody benefits from that. It's not just somebody getting a few bucks or whatever the case may be. It has to do with the growth of the company and the ability for the company to expand and put more people to work.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I think that that's been the founding principle of the United States, and that's why, you know, I think when I talk to foreign students here at Thunderbird or even when I do lectures all over the world, I keep hearing the same thing, that the United States is based on the principle that anybody can come here and make as much money as they want and then spend it any way they want. And that kind of life that you could have here, I think, should be in a corporation as well, so that you, as long as you're within the guidelines of where that company's mission statement is, you should be able to do that, and therefore the company benefits as well as you do. So we're in total agreement on that.
Okay, let me ask you this. I pick up, by the way, I have the book in my hands. This is a keeper for me.
Oh, great.
It is. Yeah, Corporate Entrepreneurship, How to Create a Thriving Entrepreneurial Spirit Throughout Your Company. I am a company exec. I picked this book up. Robert, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I get that I didn't have before? What am I going to look at differently now than before I picked the book up?
Yeah, Yeah, that's a great question, Michael Ray. I think there's several takeaways you would get from this book, and this of my books I've written, I'm most excited about this one because I think of the impact it can have on companies, and two, I think it's absolutely necessary for companies to transform themselves into this type of culture and this type of way of thinking about things. One, I think you're going to understand what the problems are in setting this up and all the internal politics and all those kinds of things that one has to deal with and think through very carefully. Two, I've really laid out a step-by-step approach, which then you modify for your own company situation. Every company is going to do it differently. 3M does it differently than Google, than Johnson & Johnson, et cetera. So I think you can just see the model, the step-by-step model, and then implement that in your particular company situation. Three, I've throughout given examples of companies that have done it in different ways, so I think it's always a feeling you feel better when you know different companies have done it, and indeed you can sort of then see what the results are and see the process they went through in doing it. And then finally, I think one of the hardest things in this, at least in my experience in working with companies on this, is, you know, the reward system and how do you do that and yet keep some kind of parity in your reporting system and job structure and job payment system. And I think I give a lot of good advice on that and reward system methods you can do, some of which are not very costly. I mean, people like to be rewarded in a lot of different ways, and it's not all monetary.
No. And we're starting to run out of time, Robert, but I want to make this point. We are in a rewards-based society. When you're a kid, your mom or your dad says, clean up your room, we'll take you to the show. Do this, you get candy. It's the same. That's the culture that we've been brought up with. You want somebody to do something for them, you give them something, you reward them. And it's the same thing whether it's going to be a corporate culture or you're in your family at home. It's back to that word, the culture again. Robert, we're running out of time. Let me ask you this, a website we can find you at.
Yes, probably the best website there is www.thunderbird.edu/WCGE, Walker Center for Global Entrepreneurship. Also, obviously, if you Google me, Google seems to have a nice website on everyone.
Dynamite. Hey, thank you so much for joining us, Robert. I appreciate your time again. The book is Corporate Entrepreneurship, Robert Hisrich, H-I-S-R-I-C-H. Robert, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Michael Ray. It was a pleasure being with you.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michelle Ricklin with us. She is the author of 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career. As a certified professional resume writer, certified employment interview consultant, Michelle has written hundreds of resumes, coached clients on every phase of a job search, and her column in the Career Corner appears monthly in Matters magazine. She's also the co-founder of selfgrowth.com, the largest social network for all self-employment. And let's say, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, Michelle, fine. I think that in today's market, people need to be held by the hand to say, this is how you go after a job, how to sit down, how to present yourself, what to look for, and what, most importantly, not to say. For as long as you've been in the business, have you found it? If I was to apply for a job with you today, I would say certain things. But if I was to apply to you for a job, apply for a job with you 10 years ago, would it be a different application? Would it be a different presentation?
It is very different. The actual way that we search is different. The values that employers have are very different, and it is not the same search as it was 10 years ago. So people that are coming into looking for a position at this point in their lives, and they have not looked for something in, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years, they're really lost because it's just a completely new ballgame.
And what is a resume about? If you got right down to the core of a resume, I'm going to apply for a job with you. What are you looking for in me? What's the one thing that you want to hear that I recognize that you need that I know I've got?
Okay. Well, a resume, just to start off, has one purpose and one purpose only. It is to get you an interview. It's a marketing tool. It's what gets you in the door, gets you in front of the right person so that you can then sell yourself in person. So basically, when you're presenting yourself within a resume, you need to really say, what is it about myself that's unique? What do I have to offer? And what differentiates me from the other 150, 200, 300 people that are also applying for the same position, and make sure that that is being highlighted and that is popping out right away.
So you have to have your own value proposition. You basically have to sit down and get yourself branded when you go in there so they look at you differently than they will the other, let's call it today, realistic 10,000 people looking for that same job.
Right, more realistically. Yes, it is all about branding, and it's a marketing tool, and you are the product, and you need to package yourself. And when you create a resume, it really needs to speak to who you are and what you have to offer. What value do you add? What can you bring to the table? And one of the most common mistakes that people make is doing something that is much more, what I would say, applicant-centric instead of employer-centric, leading with, let's say, an objective statement, which is one of those practices that I would say absolutely you most likely will not see in today's job search world, because an objective statement is I want this. I am looking for a company that offers this. And an employer really doesn't care what you want. They want to know what you bring to them. And a profile or a summary statement is really what's used, 99% of the time for an effective resume.
So effectively, it's almost like a press release. You've got to have that headline. That headline has got to be something that the potential employer will take a look at and in some way, shape, or form, solve a problem they have, fill a void, fix something that they need to fix. One of the things that I've seen over the years, Michelle, basically is this, that if you're going to go apply for a job, and I'm not an expert, so please don't hear that I am, but if you're going to apply for a job, you've got to let those people know that some way, shape, or form, you can be responsible, not as a direct salesperson, but some way, shape, or form, you're responsible for either holding that bottom line for them at a good level or helping them to increase it in some way. I think in the end result, that's what they look for.
Absolutely.
So how do I tell them that?
I'm sorry?
I said, so how do I tell them that?
So how do you tell them that? On the resume?
There
are several ways that you can be presenting that. You want a nice, strong profile, a nice, strong summary statement. I like, and this is a personal preference, but I like to put a header because, like I said, I don't want my readers to be searching for who my applicant is. I want something right up front that says who they are, senior marketing manager, or director of quality assurance, whatever that is. I want it right there so that they can see it, and then they know, okay, well, this is now I'm in the right arena as far as this person and what I'm looking for, and it might potentially be a match. If they have to go digging for it, then it's not really the best use of their time. I think that recruiters appreciate when they can just look at the first, top of that resume and say, okay, this is somebody that I should be reading. And then continuing through the resume, we want compelling information that shows here's what this person has accomplished and here's how it impacted their employer. So I use a little formula that I call my CAR formula, which is challenge, action, and result. And I ask or my clients to provide for me, well, what were you challenged to do in your career? What did you do? How did you do it? And what were the positive end results? And what was the impact on your employer? And that, I think, shows the reader, well, here's what this person's done. Here's what they've accomplished. And that's really the best indicator of what they can do for their for their next employer, what they've done previously.
You know, and I've learned along the way that nobody really cares about you. And this is not coming from a hardcore place. This is a realistic place. They don't care about what you have to offer until they realize how what you have will benefit them. And after listening to what you just said, if I was going to apply for a job, I think this is what I would do. If I'm going to apply for a job with you, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to Google you, and I'm going to find out what it is that you offer everybody. And then based on what it is that you're offering, what you have to give to the public, I'm going to find 5 challenges that you have that you need to move through to get to where you want to be. And then I'm going to take what I can do and apply it to how I can help in the challenge to accomplish what it is, and then we're all winners across the board.
Absolutely, and that's just all part of the homework phase, and this is definitely a place that particularly the younger generation is just not getting, that there's homework to be done when you're looking for a job. If you're going to position yourself and present yourself to an employer, you'd better know who that employer is. And then you can kind of steer your interview by having that information and being armed and prepared to say, well, this is what you do, and this is how I can contribute, and this is what I can do for you when I come on board.
I think that's really what it comes down to. I'm going to tell you a story, but you got to promise not to tell anybody. This is our secret here, okay?
Not telling anyone.
Well, thank you. Now I feel good now. That 20, 25 years ago, I had some financial problems, and I had a particular business. I was married at the time, and I had to make some money, and there was this ad in the paper, and it said, used car salesman. Okay. So anyway, this is what we don't want to tell anybody. So I'm driving down the street. Now, my car turned into that lot. It was not me. The car turned in there. So I walked in. I sat down, and the guy looked at me, and he said, what do you know about cars? I said, nothing. I can sell anything. He said, when do you want to start? That was the key. This is what he was looking for. He could care less about anybody who knows anything about cars. What can you do for me? I can build your bottom line.
Right.
And that's really what it was. That's our secret now, the used car thing. We don't want that out. But when you come down to it, that's truly what it is.
Yeah, it's really all about how are you going to have a positive impact on our company.
Now, by the way, I have a great idea. We're running a little bit short of time, but this is what I would love to do. In today's market, today's economy, there are so many people out there looking for jobs, okay? And we've got a pretty good-sized listening audience out there. It's coming from all different directions. I'm going to have Ask Radio Susie to get a hold of you, and maybe we can do like a weekly 15, 20-minute, this is a job tip of the week kind of thing. If you could go for something like that, I think it would be great across the board for everybody.
Absolutely. I have lots of tips. Some of them people won't like, but they're nice and solid, and And definitely, I have a lot of ideas on how to kind of break through that mantra of there are no jobs. And I really don't buy that. I don't buy that there are no jobs. Yes, it is a very difficult job market, don't get me wrong. But there are no jobs is just self-defeating. It's the people that are really taking this job search seriously and approaching it and really attacking it strategically that are finding what they're looking for.
Oh, and by the way, if we have a 9.1 unemployment rate, Michelle, that means we've got 90.9% of the people out there that are working, so that validates what you just said. Now, is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. I am at www.ricklinresources.com, and I'll spell that because it's not necessarily the way it sounds. It's www.ricklanresources.com.
Great. Hey, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it all, and we're looking forward to more of you.
Sounds good.
Take care. Good night.
Take care.
Well, I'm going to wait. You're going to feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Down the street in a trance, you fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Michael Hohmeyer back with us, legal specialist in business and corporate law. Hey, it's the law segment. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Michael Ray.
Did you bring your Prozac with you?
Oh, it's tough to stay mellow, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I'm watching what's going on, Michael, and I'm listening to both sides of the aisle, and I'm listening to the Obama side and the Boehner side. But the one thing that I have been noticing that's horrible, and it was about a day or so ago, that was one of the elected officials. It was a congressman, and I'm sorry I didn't write the state down that he was from, but it was televised, so this is not hearsay. That he was talking to the NAACP and the Black Caucus, and he was basically talking about it. We're going back to the Jim Crow era, and don't let them make them. Don't let them make the African American second class citizens. So when they're losing the feel of the vote, then they pull the race card. So now that they're going to get people voting for them because the other side is racist, has nothing to do with the economy, the ability for this man to run this country, which he can't, or any of the other issues that we're facing today. And that's really hitting below the belt.
It really is, and it's unfortunately, it seems, part of a very sad history that we've seen developing over the last 2.5 years, very contrary to what we were sold. When people were voting in the election in 2008, that we were going to get a unifier, not a divider, and we were all going to work together, and people weren't going to be pitting groups against each other. But that seems to be all that's happened over the last 2.5 years, that this administration, and when it had its allies in Congress, was pitting Americans of different groups against Americans in other groups. I don't think that's what the majority of the people want, of whatever race. And I think that that's going to be become increasingly obvious that it's an intolerable distraction from really the serious issues that need to be addressed and that need to be addressed by all Americans working together. And I think all Americans want to work together and are ready to work together and don't appreciate these kinds of divisive tactics.
No, as a matter of fact, the class warfare is going continuously. The man goes to, well, he goes to Martha's Vineyards, you know, on a vacation that that would cost a mint. It had to cost a mint. And then he comes back with, is it the Section 5 housing that allows everybody into a particular place? But what he wants to do is he wants to level the playing field and let, you know, people who can't afford to be there because there's nothing more than wealthy white people there. That's where the problem is with this kind of rhetoric, and this is scary. Michael, somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to be left shot out in the street because the ignition of hate is going rampant in this administration.
It's very unfortunate whenever people try to divide in order to conquer. It flies in the face of the American experience, the point of which is to unite, to bring people who are individuals together and create something out of nothing that exists, not because of geography, not because of religion, not because of class, but it exists because it's philosophy. People wanted to create this country out of a wilderness, not just a physical wilderness, but an intellectual wilderness. And that was a huge change 200 years ago. And I don't think that the American spirit has changed much since then, at least the spirit as it's held by most people. And they do not appreciate and indeed resent these kinds of divisive tactics, which are typically, but not always, played on as people lose any other card to play. This is all that they've got. The only way that the administration really has a hope, given the poll numbers today, if they remain the case tomorrow and through the election, the only chance they have of reelection is to pit Americans against each other out of fear, and that's going to require labeling, and it's going to require blackballing, and it's going to require mudslinging. You know, we see that Rick Perry is accused of being stupid, and Michelle Bachmann is accused of being a Christian, God forbid, et cetera. These are all name-calling. It's ad hominem attacks. It's because they're intellectually bankrupt. They can't justify the administration's history and the Democrats' history based on the last 4 or 6 years of economic performance. They have nothing else to play. This is the card they have left.
Michael, look what Ron Paul did. He sent out, you know, a newswire to any woman who's ever kissed Rick Perry. You know, they're looking for a problem to destroy him. I want to see somebody who come in who's tough enough, A, to be a leader. I don't care what religion they – well, there is a religion I would not like them to be. But I don't care what religion that they are, what ethnicity that they are. The idea is get in there and do the job. And I believe this in my heart of hearts. Whether it, and by the way, the last thing I heard was Hillary's jumping in there, and she may go up against Obama, which is going to be a very interesting split with that Democratic ticket. But that said, once somebody gets to that position of power, and it's power, they're no longer a man, they're no longer a woman, they're no longer a Democrat, they're no longer a Republican, they're no longer anything. They are the most powerful person on this planet, and that's what they are. And you need somebody that understands how a business works, cash in, cash out, and when you're in trouble, what not to do, and has a team around him or her, has a team around them that knows how to keep us out of trouble and strong enough to stand toe-to-toe with anybody who is going to intimidate us in any way, shape, or form.
I'm 100% confident that the results of the election next year will be based upon performance. The actual performance, the past that we've had, and the promise of more of the same for the next 4 years, or the promise of a different course for the next 4 years. I don't think that people are going to make up their mind based on racism. I don't think people are going to make up their mind based on class. I don't think people are going to make up their mind based on tax envy. I think people are going to make up their mind because they think that there are important issues beyond those distractions. That we don't have time to waste our attention on, that we need to be focused on reviving this economy, returning to our past traditions, and reclaiming the economic vibrancy and success that I believe is just sitting out there like low-hanging fruit, waiting to be plucked from the bottom limb of the tree if we will only reach out our arm to take it. And, of course, doing so requires a drastic reversal from what we've done over the last 4 to 6 years. But people will be making their decisions based on the right kinds of issues, economics, foreign policy. Are you happy with where things are, how things have gone over the last 4 to 6 years, and do you want them to go on in that way or in a different way? Those are going to be valid reasons for making a political decision next year, and I believe that will give increased legitimacy to whomever is elected president, and I don't believe it'll be a re-election.
Here's my concern. The concern is we have a particular society that generated a culture. That culture has been here since basically day one. It is a Judeo-Christian ethic any way that you look at it. If you maneuver other philosophies, other ideologies within the construct of the government in and of itself, you begin to change things, the Sharia law that some of the different states are starting to look at to take on. 2006, Keith Ellison became the first Muslim elected in the United States Congress, and he was sworn in on a Quran. Now, I have no problem with that if it's not going to be what it is that we're doing. If you swear to something, then it's got to be in conjunction with the law of the land, not a religious law, the law of the land. The Bible in itself was a, or is, symbolically, the Judeo-Christian ethic that we created this country with. You know, you and I have talked about it before. I'm Jewish, but I was raised, everybody that I was raised around was, for the most part, Catholic. And I celebrated Christmas, and I sang Christmas carols in schools and so on and so forth. I wasn't standing out there with the ACLU screaming and complaining that I was emotionally upset because they didn't look at me. That's not where it is. If we don't want the country the way that it's been to develop into America that has enough jobs, enough housing, enough food, enough to put on the table to help everybody, then quit now and then let somebody else come in and take over. You don't come to a country that when you run away from another country because you were frightened to death of being killed, being tortured, being raped, whatever the case may be, and come here to be safe, and then within a month, a year, turn around and try to make the country here like what you ran away from. I don't get this. I don't understand the logic.
The Judeo-Christian tradition is a tradition of tolerance and a tradition of acceptance, and it is a tradition when practiced in its truest forms, if I can actually say that, but I think as a generalization it is correct, that embraces the idea of a separation of church and state, render unto Caesar versus, you know, render unto God, and also the idea of allowing disparate religious views and religions themselves to flourish on American soil together, all at the same time. That's been our tradition for 200 years, for the most part, with exceptions to every general rule, but still, that's been the Judeo-Christian tradition that's given us this tradition of religious tolerance that has matched so well with Americanism, and that allows us, if we will not be distracted by those who seek to divide on the basis of religion, or on the basis of wealth, or on the basis of class, or on the basis of race, or on the all these other silly little bases, but instead we say, look, there are serious issues facing us, and on those issues, it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, or whatever, or not, but you can say to yourself, I care about the economy, I care about national security, and these are issues on which there are serious issues, and we need to be spending our time on what's really the major issues of the day, and not be distracted by these people who have no other card to play than division, who are trying to pit the house against itself in order to make sure that it does not stand. I think that that division strategy will fail this administration as it has failed his party in the last election, and all those who have tried to prevail by using division and divisiveness. It's as a smokescreen for distracting from the real issues of the day. These issues are too serious. They are life and death issues. In my business law practice, I have seen the horribly constricting effect of a terrible economy and wrong-headed economic views on the ability of my clients to start and grow their businesses, to hire people and put fellow Americans to work. My clients, as well as myself personally, are desperate for a return to traditional American values. I don't believe that they're going to allow themselves to be distracted by the policies of division. I just don't believe it.
Now, by the way, we're running out of time, Michael, but the one thing that I do want to say is this. NBC recently They banned wearing an American flag or, the lapel, the sign on your coat or your jacket. And the reason that they did that, that they didn't want to go one side or the other with a cause. Where did they get the United States of America is a cause, and to ban that and not allow the flag to be shown? My feeling is this. Whatever it comes down to, I'm an American. I'm a former Marine. I love this country. I will do a Pledge of Allegiance. I will sing the national anthem, and I'm not embarrassed about it in any way, shape, or form. And it has nothing to do with taking someone else and pushing them under the rug so I can have what I want. This is the country that you come to, then follow the rules. You can't follow the rules, go away.
You know, NBC isn't going to win itself any friends or viewers with wrongheaded and silly politics like that. People, Republicans and Democrats, and those of no party, the independents, they're all generally agreeable on the concept. We love this country. It's an exceptional country, and the people in it that have made it exceptional and that are going to continue to return it to its exceptional course are not embarrassed about wearing the flag. It's a symbol that unites everybody, and it speaks to everybody. And again, the policies of division, whether they're practiced by the administration or by NBC, are not going to be embraced by a majority of this country. And if people don't believe that, they're going to find that out next year.
No question about it. Michael, we got to go. And a website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
My pleasure. Look forward to it already.
Take care. Good night.
So bye, Michael.
And wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Gay Culverhouse with us, former president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. She's the author of Throwaway Players, the concussion crisis from Pee-wee football to the NFL. She's responsible for the presence of an independent neurologist on the sidelines of every NFL game. Her advocacy work has been featured in the New York Times, ESPN, PBS. She's the author of, again, The Throwaway Players, The Concussion Crisis, Pee-wee Football to NFL. And Gay, welcome to the show.
Well, I certainly appreciate your having me tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, this is an issue that we just took for granted for so many years. You know, these guys, they get out there, and that's a tough game. There's no question about that. And they get thrown around, and they get beaten up. You know, I played football when I was in high school, obviously not professionally. But at the same time, there is that element that if you get hit hard enough and if you get hit in the right place, your life is over. You could end up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life.
Well, and that happens. Unfortunately, it happens at all ages. You may have seen that on August 22nd, a 17-year-old high school player out of Maryland was on the field and was hit and was killed.
Yeah, no question. But I think really what we have to look at here is, you know, you can have the neurologist on the sidelines. Football is a tough game, any way you look at it. And the key is this is going, this, I'm not going to say it could happen. This is going to happen out there. What do you do? Is it, you know, do you have better equipment? Do you have football helmets that have more protection? Because if we don't, then the game shouldn't be played.
Well, there are two responses I have to that. One, the NFL is making a number of rules that were instituted last season and this season to make the game safer. For example, no helmet-on-helmet contact. They've changed the kickoff. They've put rules in place to make the game safer. And interestingly, the people that complain the most when those safety rules are put into place are the fans. The fans enjoy the violence of the game. And when we make it safer, they object. And that's a sad commentary on us as humans, but we've been doing it since the gladiators. We've been sitting in our boxes, drinking wine, beer, having hors d'oeuvres, and watching men beat each other up. And when you look at the names of the teams, the Bears, the Panthers, the Jaguars, we're not far from where we were thousands of years ago in many aspects. In terms of making the equipment safer, one thing you have to understand about concussions is you don't actually have to be hit to suffer a concussion. You can have a whiplash, which has exactly the same effect of throwing your brain against the front part of the skull and it ricocheting and hitting the back part of the skull. And so that is as fierce a concussion as a helmet-on-helmet contact. So you can have concussions without having, you know, a helmet on, without having actual contact.
Now, by the way, when we deal with this, and when we go back, you know, to the gladiators, I mean, that was to the death. There's no question about that. And what we have out, and again, I was in high school. I played football. You were out there, and you were going to get them. And the tougher you got, the better it was. And everybody up in the stands were screaming and yelling and going for it. I would even look at, as far as violence goes, look at boxing. Boxing, it's a skilled sport. But when you really come down to it, look what they've turned it into. Not necessarily boxing, but when they've gone on to these
in the cage fights.
Yeah. I mean, those guys are just—they're close to, quote unquote, close to death. I mean, they're except for getting hit in the groin, there's nothing that they don't do. They throw people down, they punch them out, and they do all of this stuff, and people love it. And as long as there's a dollar made, it's going to continue on.
And you can see in places like Las Vegas, this is replacing most of the entertainment. I was out in Vegas not long ago, and I know a young man who trains as an ultimate fighter. And it's funny because they gave him the head safety lecture, and he was laughing with me the other night. And he said, they had us out there for a weekend teaching us about head safety, but our job is to go out there and ram people's heads, to get them to knock out, to get a concussed person on the mat so that we win. And that ultra-violent sport is eclipsing all of the tame aspects, if you will, about two-minute rounds in boxing.
Yeah, now, by the way, let's take it to wrestling for a moment. You know, the steroids, the hormones, the rest of it that they use, and these guys don't get a break. You know, as they're flying off the top of the ropes, you know, halfway across the ring and landing on someone. Now, a lot of it, if you watch very closely and if you're there, you can see a lot of it is just not quite as violent as they make it out to be. But still, these guys are going night after night after night, 12 months a year, and they've got to have something to keep them rolling. So there goes the drugs, and they want audience approval, and that's what they get.
You're absolutely right. And I'll tell you an interesting fact that I learned in researching this book. The average age that a player starts using a performance-enhancing substance is age 14.
Wow.
And the person that usually secures it is the mother or the older brother.
That's interesting.
And the moms get it. The moms usually go for the human growth hormone, and they tell the doctors their son should be taller. And they talk these doctors into giving it to them. The older brothers usually give anabolic steroids because those are more readily available on the black market. But it's a trickle down from college and from the pros. And when you look at it, you know, the 14-year-old wants to play on the high school team, so he's got to be bigger and faster. The high school player wants to make it to the Ducks or the Gators, so he takes it to be bigger and stronger and faster. And then you're in college, you need to get to the NFL, the ultimate brass ring. So you enhance your program of performance enhancement so that you can reach the top brass ring. And once you're in the NFL, you've got to keep it up or you'll be eclipsed by the next college recruit.
And the dollars that they get, you know, as a matter of fact, that's interesting also. When you go through that process, there is a social element of growing up that these kids miss. And they miss it because they become heroes. They become above and beyond reproachable. And they're making, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And there's that area in their life that they don't get, which makes them extremely vulnerable if they do get hit. Now, here's the big question. How do we protect the youngsters coming up from this? How do we alert them in such a way that they're not just hearing it, and yet the value for going through this and being, quote-unquote, as brutal as they can is going to get them paid and make them famous?
Well, you know, it's a tough, tough job to try to do it. I've watched my 7-year-old grandson, and I've learned a lot from watching him. But what I think we've got to do, quite honestly, is start with this generation of 7-8-year-olds, because that's when you enter peewee. That's when you enter the league, if you will. And we've got to train them to put the I back in team. You know the old phrase, there is no I in team. My belief is we have to put the I back in team. We've got to teach children to self-identify when they've been concussed. And it's very easy to know. If you ask anyone who's had a concussion, they knew immediately. They saw stars. Their vision was blurred. They wanted to vomit. They had ringing in their ears. If you get to that point, you know something's wrong. So instead of staying in the game, self-identify, tell your coach, tell your mother or father, and get yourself out so you can heal that brain. If we train this young group of kids and bring them up through the ages, we should set the new generation of safety. And I've got a program called Headstrong Player that has videos and a curriculum so that YMCA's, Boys Club, Pee Wee Leagues, Pop Warner, everyone can use it. It's for soccer players and any sports kids. But it teaches them to put the I in team and self-identify.
Now, by the way, as we go along here, when we are dealing with this, I want to make sure that we talk about the very important, the players outreach, the program. And it's the retired NFL players getting their benefits, et cetera. You got a lot of players that were hit hard, and it's almost like coming back from military, coming back from combat, and they don't really get the attention that they should get because they've, quote-unquote,
right,
put their life out on the line for people, and it happened to have been entertainment, which we will pay hundreds of millions plus dollars for. And they need to be taken care of also. So, as an outsider, how can I help with the outreach program?
Well, I appreciate your asking that question. If you can let people know that it exists, that's the main thing we need right now. I mean, of course, we always need funding, but what we are doing is trying to reach every former NFL player and let him know what the benefits are that the NFL offers to them. Unfortunately, when they retire, they don't leave a forwarding address with the NFL. and they could be in too bad a shape to leave a forwarding address. But the thing is, the NFL offers many programs for retired players. What we do is we go around the country and alert the retired players what their benefits are, and then we help the player access those funds, whether we have to provide medical testing or clerical support or whatever we have to do, we do for free to alert the players and match them with the NFL program that's available. And with the new CBA, there is more than $88,000 per year available for assisted living. It's now $104,000 available for assisted living. And there are all sorts of screening processes for heart disease, prostate cancer. There are a myriad of programs that the NFL is offering. We just need the players to be able to know about them and take advantage of them.
Well, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time now. Where is it that we can find you, a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www.playersoutreach.org.
Okay, www.playersoutreach.org. Gay, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and good luck. I think it's a great thing that you're doing.
Well, I certainly appreciate your help.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. Try to apply myself, teach my heart how to sing. Yeah, you can bet I'll go my way by myself, like a bird on the...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I'll build a world all my own.
Jim Warner with us. He's the co-author of The Drama-Free Office, a guide to healthy collaboration with your team, co-works, and your boss. He began his entrepreneurial career at age 29. He founded a software company, Precision Visuals, Inc. He evolved quickly from developer to entrepreneur to leader, experiencing the full range of business transitions. High growth, team building, recessions, downsizing, restructuring, repositioning, succession planning and implementation. And since 1995, he's worked with over 2,500 CEOs in multinational public companies, entrepreneurships, partnerships, and family businesses. As an advisor to top executives, he's an expert on how to expand their suite of leadership skills while breeding enduring authenticity and collaboration within their teams. And let us say hi, Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Jim, you know, the one thing, how do we get through an office in a day without the drama? Because without the drama, it seems that they don't go home with any kind of badge of honor.
Well, but drama is pervasive in almost any office environment you're going to encounter. And our guidance to listeners is make sure that you're out of it yourself. So if the drama is being played out on a stage in your office, choose to be in the audience versus being a participant.
Now, by the way, when we deal with drama, you know, there's so many offices that have drama. People come to work, they bring their stuff to work, and they don't seem to realize that there's a distinction between when they're at home and when they're getting paid to do a particular job. And I would venture to guess, and I'm quite confident with all of your experience, with enough drama within an organization, within an office, it affects the bottom line. The income that's supposed to be there gets hit and it gets diluted.
Yeah, we actually look at drama as any behavior that drains energy or blocks clean, authentic interactions. And whenever that happens, you're going to inhibit creativity and productivity in organizations, and that has a direct impact on bottom line. So that's why we really advocate our work starting top down with the most senior people committing to be drama free.
Okay, now, by the way, how do you deal with that with somebody who is running the place? You know, I'm sure you're going to run up into against a lot of egos that won't even, number one, admit to it. But once you clear that, how do you work through that to go to the trickle-down effect?
Well, you're correct that it must start with the top person. We've been privileged in our work to be able to have the confidence and trust of those top people who desire to have more authentic relationships and collaborative work in their organizations. And we say before we can take it down to your staff, it must start with you for you to get out of your own drama. And so we say anytime you find yourself in a complaining mode, there's four basic types: complaining, cynicism, controlling, and being the pleaser or noncommittal person. And so we help the senior person, and then by trickle-down effect, all in his organization, first get clear on which of the different drama types do you tend to fall into, and then we give them antidotes to catch themselves before they fall into the trap of drama.
Now, by the way, a lot of this has to do with, quote-unquote, the leader, and there's no question about that person that's absolutely at the top. And if that person is at the top is truly a leader, or they know what skills that they don't have that has hired a leader, now all of a sudden it's a different world, because when we are dealing with a leader, it's somebody who's going to bring people together, collectively bring people together, mobilizing people to effectively move in one direction. And many, many businesses today do not have that.
Yes. And what we advocate for leaders is, first of all, to be open to feedback from any form you can get it, to stay curious about how can you improve not only your domain skills in your enterprise, but also your interaction skills so you can breed collaboration among your people and delegate and empower versus having to micromanage. So the first step we encourage for leaders is to take a drama assessment. Sometimes we call ourselves the drama doctors, and we've created a diagnostic that they can use online, which essentially diagnoses the type of drama they are most prone to fall into. Once you know the type, the complainer, cynic, controller, or caretaker, then you can then take specific steps so you don't fall into that trap.
One of the things that I've seen over the years, and the people that fall into that trap are old school. You know, it's the command and control. And today we've transitioned to, you said it, we've transitioned to collaboration. We want employees. We want employees to be part and parcel of the business. They don't have to be involved in the, actually in the profit of itself, but they've got to be involved in the business in such a way that they feel it's part of them and they're recognized for what they put into that business so the business gains.
Yeah. And all people in an organization are desiring some type of recognition. They also want, most of the people we run into really desire to do a good job for the organization. And when they can be given their own, I call it sandbox to play in, be able to be delegated and empowered to do their job, and then get a sense of recognition for that, they normally will operate at very high levels. It's superiors who get caught up in having to micromanage and control, who have to be right all of the time, impose their agenda and ego on the rest of their teams, that begin to stunt the creativity and productivity of their teams, and that's what creates drama.
Now, by the way, I think one of the hardest things, and it's in your press release, that you have to deal with, in the general sense of the word of you, is the risk of confronting drama-prone people. There's got to be a method to do so, because you just can't walk up and do it. You'll create havoc like you've never seen before.
Yes, and we advocate a couple steps for that. The first is if you have someone who's caught in drama, again, they're a chronic complainer or gossip or the micromanager type, or someone caught in, you know, cynicism, the Eeyore of the office, the first step is actually antithetical. We actually encourage you to build rapport with them. Take a softer approach. Find things to like in them. Actually begin to build some trust. When you do build trust, you then have a chance to suggest different behaviors that would be more productive for the group. The second step when you find someone caught in drama is to put yourself in their shoes. Oftentimes, they may have a difficult home environment. They may have their own boss who's putting extraordinary pressure on them to perform. So as you put yourself in their shoes, you begin to empathize with them, build rapport, and then you have a chance to have an influence on their behavior. The other key point is to don't go into this from an emotionless place. If you let emotion overtake you in your exchanges with someone in drama, it's like 2 5-year-olds on the playground having a discussion. So get out of the emotional component of it and say, what are my options for dealing with this person in a clean fashion?
You know, an interesting thing happened to me just now that I was looking at this, and then I realized your co-author is your daughter. So the question, Jim, the question really would be with Kaylee that in everybody who puts anything to pen goes through this, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, whatever, there comes that part in the book that they begin to realize a dimension of the subject matter that they weren't aware of. And especially with the two of you being close, where was it that you two had a look at each other and realized there was more to what you thought it was?
Well, when we had worked with a couple hundred teams together, we began to see the patterns arising in these teams where energy got sucked out of organizations. And we got back and we began to look for patterns and distilled it down to these 4 different drama types. And then over the years, we developed these different methods of being able to puncture the drama and get people back to an authentic place. So it probably took us about 5 to 7 years before we were able to distill down what we'd seen in the marketplace and put it down into the diagnostics and then the tools for dispelling the drama. It was interesting, Michael, in our own creation of the book, we ran into our own drama. I'd get frustrated at her of how she would redline some of my writing. She'd get frustrated at me when I would micromanage or demand, you know, she meet tighter deadlines. And we'd have to catch ourselves, take a deep breath, pause, own that part of the drama that we had created. And when we could own it, we could begin to laugh at it. And then what we say is we began to push the reset button and go back to mature behavior. So we had to deal with it ourselves in the creation of the book.
That's where I was going with that, because it's a learning process. And when you write about something, it's got to be something within you that you've conquered at one time or another. But as you really dig into it, and especially if it's family that you're dealing with, this stuff's going to come up. You get to look at it, and what that does, it puts a dimension into the writing that you wouldn't have had before.
Very much so, as a father-daughter team and raising my other children, that letting go of my need to be right, especially as a parent raising elementary and middle school children, especially and challenging teenagers, I wanted to impose my control and my will on them. And my third teenager to begin to realize that that wasn't working. And a softer, more collaborative approach, letting them make decisions, letting my children be my teacher, helped me build greater rapport with them. So when I did want to shoot that silver bullet to get something across to them, I'd built up enough relational capital that they would really listen. And interestingly, that was extrapolatable into the business space.
No, it's wonderful, because I'm going to go back to where I was a few minutes ago, whenever it was, the command and the control versus collaboration. And what you just said is you transitioned. And when you transitioned, you realized the transition because of the challenge and the obstacles that came up between the two of you and how critical collaboration is.
And to get to that place, it required setting aside the ego. And the ego wants 3 things: to be in control, to be recognized and approved, and to prove that I'm right. Yeah. All 3 of those drain energy, and they end up having warring silos as opposed to collaborative interaction. And so much of our work is getting people to let go of your need to control, let go of your need to even be approved or liked, and especially the need to be right. Would you rather be effective or be right?
Yeah, by the way, interesting point. And there's so many people who would rather be right, because they've lived their entire lives with somebody telling them they're wrong, and they're going to go out of their way to prove they're right until they can come up against it and begin to realize that proving yourself right is not right.
Well, look at our education system. You have to get into the right schools, raise the right, you know, wear the right clothes, hang out with the right friends, drive the right car. And especially if you look at the legal profession, it's to prove I'm right, you're wrong, win, lose. If you can let go of the win, lose, and just go out and play the game in a collaborative fashion, we find curiosity, creativity rise enormously. So it's actually undoing a lot of our learning from childhood.
Oh, by the way, I have a great recommendation for you. I think that it would be extremely important if your daughter and yourself took the book, gave it to our politicians in Washington, and had them take a look at it and learn.
We've thought of that also in churches,
yeah,
in hospital settings, all nonprofit settings, the educational system in schools. The principles are universal. We chose to go in the office environment first because that had been our primary experience. If there's a sequel to the book, it would be the drama-free family,
yeah,
or the drama-free nonprofit.
I really think the drama-free government, and I'm not getting political with you. It's not left or right. That's not where I'm at with this. Both sides have the same problems. They're not collaborating, and that's where the problem is. And I really believe that the essence of what you're teaching the businesses should be taught, yes, in school, yes, in government. But, well, actually, if you taught it in school, those kids that went on to become elected officials would automatically have that inherent within their ability to deal with people.
Totally agree with you. If we had a drama-free government, a place of collaboration, and setting aside my agenda, things like the debt crisis, the economic issues we're facing now, health care, immigration, I'm convinced you could get to win-win solutions. There will be some stretching by both sides, some potential pain, and now here's the tough word, some vulnerability. And so if government officials or family members or school officials are willing to go to those places, then you can get to synergistic exchanges and solutions. The problem is need to be right is so rooted deeply in our culture. One of our challenges as authors and consultants is to help unroot that and get people into a collaborative space.
Okay, and what you're really dealing with, and I'm a very firm believer in this, is the rule basically is this. The rule is, to stem to where I'm going with this, is that a good teacher knows when to be a student and a good leader knows when to follow. You know, I probably change hats 4 or 5 times a week, you know, with this. And the idea here is when you are doing what you do, when people begin to realize that you're moving towards the same goal, things start to work out. And it takes somebody who's been there, done that, to look over your shoulder and to say, hey, this is what you're missing. This is an opportunity that you're not seeing. That basic foundation that people make decisions from, businesses make decisions from. If you look deep into it and if you're not there, you can take a look and see what they don't see. And I really believe that's what you're doing.
Yes. Yep. And if we can empower leaders, the phrase we use is to lead from a step behind, not care who gets the credit. Empower and cheer for your subordinates. Be the wind beneath their wings. Magic can happen. To do that requires creation of trust. We've got the following definition of trust I'd like to share with you. It's credibility plus reliability. You get things done on time. Plus adaptability. You can change your agenda. You can be flexible. Divided by self-interest. So the key is, can I set aside my self-interest and look for the good of my team as opposed to my own agenda?
Makes sense to me. Jim, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, thank you for asking. It's www.dramafreeoffice.com. And one thing that we found to be very popular on that site is a free drama diagnostic survey where in 10 minutes you can assess very quickly the type of drama in both yourself or your coworkers.
What a great idea.
Been very popular. It takes only 10 minutes, and it's free.
Wonderful. That one I had said, what a great idea. I think it's phenomenal. Jim, thank you thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thank you for having me on again, especially for your championing the idea of a collaborative world. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Death, where are we?
Whatever you've done, it's all over.
Drama. I knew it. It's right there. The English is coming. How one language is sweeping the world. Our guest author is Leslie Dutton Downer. Leslie's a former lecturer at Harvard University. She holds a PhD in comparative literature from Harvard and co-authored the acclaimed Essential Shakespeare Handbook. And let us say hi, Leslie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I want to read the first couple of sentences in your press release because that really says it all, and I would venture to guess that most people have no idea about this. There are currently 6,000 languages spoken on the planet, and yet you can utter the word hello virtually anywhere from Timbuktu to multinational space station, and you can be understood. English has fast become the number one language for everything from business, science, diplomacy and education, entertainment and environmentalism to socializing and beyond. Yet, Leslie, it's kind of a surprise because we have such a fight to keep it constant right here in the country. I think that's amazing and wonderful.
Yeah, that's a funny thing that you actually bring that up, because I wondered about whether the very fact that English is not officially the national language for the United States, and the fact that we have to kind of talk about language in this country and which language are we going to use in our classrooms and our communities and think about English in so many different ways, whether that's part of the story of the vitality of the language that's made it so interesting to people around the world. I wonder if there's a connection between that, but I don't know if people have actually answered that question.
And I really wonder if people, you know, I'm a little bit surprised because I hadn't thought about it until I took a look at the press release and read what I just read. And I thought that's kind of an interesting thing, because we have so many challenges with the language here in this country. And yet at the same time, as you said, it's growing rapidly. Where was it that you saw that, or the light bulb went on to realize that English is spreading?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Obviously not in the United States, because as you say, you know, here in the United States, we sort of take it for granted, but we also have around 2 million people who are American citizens who don't yet have mastery of the language. and even more people who are living in the United States who don't speak English fluently, and yet at the same time, there are exponentially growing numbers of people around the world who are trying to learn English as fast as they can, and you see them. The way I became interested in this topic, as you know, somebody who watches languages around the world and listens and tries to learn some of them, and then is aware of how languages is, you know, used in different contexts in different countries. I think one of the light bulb moments for me was being on a train in Eastern Europe and hearing kids who were from the Czech Republic interacting with kids who were from Turkey and from France and from other countries. Nobody in the group that I was listening to was from an English-speaking country, and they were all young people who were interested in music and culture, and they wanted to talk about their holiday time, and they were on a train, and they had a few hours together, and they immediately started conversing in English, and there was no question that that was the language they were going to use. And, you know, they ended up being able to talk about films and music and their travel plans in English. It was sometimes broken English, but that was a pretty surprising moment, because that was a place where not so long ago you would have heard German as the first language to try. And all of a sudden, here we are with a generation where English is the automatic go-to language. No one even questioned it.
And let's talk technology for a moment. I have watched my sister get into some of these different groups on the Internet. And obviously they speak English, and she has no idea when she'll make a comment, et cetera, and somebody fires back at her or agrees with her, whatever the case may be, if they're even in the country. And I'm wondering if, you know, the texting, the Internet, the rest of it hasn't caused a base of this to be.
Yeah, well, obviously this is an area of huge fascination to people who are involved with language and language change. It's just how this technology is changing the language and how technology has changed languages in the past, like how printing technology changed language, or even radio and television. These are major influences. And the Internet is an interesting example, because you have these individual people talking to one another, as you say, not necessarily even knowing where they are, and sometimes using, you know, often using English in a way that is kind of broken, and you can't tell. Well, maybe they were just in a hurry, so they were dropping some words because they were in a rush, or it's because they don't really know how to use the language in the same way that a native speaker would. But no one seems to really mind, because I think that there's a kind of ethic of efficiency and, you know, getting your message across. So people don't stop and necessarily say, "Hey, you forgot to, you know, use this particular."
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
Jadra Hymer with us. She's the author of Turn Your Child's ADHD Stress into Success. She's a child behaviorist and ADHD expert, an educator. She's had over 30 years' experience working with children. Her specialty is ADHD. She taught college education courses for 9 years and founded Success Point, which is a private school and a consulting center. That's for children with ADHD and varying degrees of ADHD. And through her personal and professional experience, combined with years of ADHD research, she's helped countless children turn their ADHD stress into success. Jadra, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Jadra, when we hear this ADHD, we hear the term bannered about, thrown about. Has it been just recently, when I say recently, within the last few years, that professionals have actually realized what this thing was that was the concern of so many parents and children?
Yes, it's fairly recent. I would say probably in the last 10 to 15 years is when they have really put their focus on it and come up with the ADHD diagnosis.
Now, by the way, your own personal experience, what was it that you noticed, you saw within your children that triggered you to get started on the path that you took as regards to fighting this thing?
Well, I have five children, all who have ADHD to varying degrees, and my fourth son had it very extreme. He had difficulty throughout the day. In the morning, he couldn't get dressed without me saying, okay, put your pants on. Okay, put the toy back down now. Get your shirt on. All right, back over here. Let's get your shoes on. Getting from the cupboard to the table with his bowl, he would be off someplace else, losing things, forgetting things, just a variety of things. And so by the time he was starting school and started having challenges there, I knew that in order for him to have success in life, I was going to have to commit myself and devote myself to researching ADHD and becoming an expert on it.
Is some of the problem that when, especially with some of the kids in school, they'll have the symptoms, but are there things that look like ADHD that are not ADHD, and the kids are treated for it, and nothing ever happens, no change?
Yes, and interestingly enough, a lot of children that people may think that they have ADHD, what actually is the problem is they're not getting enough sleep or they're not eating well, and so their blood sugar drops and they become spacey from that. And so one of the first things I do with parents is do what I call fed into bed and make sure that they get plenty of sleep and eat well.
Okay, so in essence, it's just a proper nutrition, not so much diet, but the proper nutrition and enough sleep does help. Now, we look at ADHD, you go back 10, 15, 20 years ago, ADHD was starting to, they were becoming aware of it. And then the next thing we did was we over-medicated these kids, and if they looked like they were having a problem, we gave them some medication, and that was supposed to be the end of it. That doesn't work, does it?
Well, it's interesting. Only about 40% of children have any help with the medication. And part of the problem is that the ADHD can, that the ADHD characteristics, as I mentioned, can be a result of the sleep or eat issues, but it also if they have thyroid problems, if they've got candida, there's a lot of other health issues that are triggering the ADHD characteristics. And so it's very important for parents to have their child have a complete physical to address any issues that may be causing these symptoms that need to be addressed and taken care of, not just have the symptoms numbed.
Now, Jadra, one of the things that I noticed about ADHD, and I've done a tremendous amount of interviews, I've been exposed to it, I probably have it myself. And the one thing that I have noticed is that with kids especially, if they have the problems and they don't know what it is, and the parents don't know what it is, and you haven't tied it down to a particular tag of ADHD, that it kind of drives them back. They can't fit in with the rest of the kids, which can cause emotional problems and just many things that you have a hard time fixing later on in life.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that happens so often. If parents and educators aren't aware that what is really going on is the ADHD, they may label the child as lazy, as a misbehavior, that it's just strictly due to bad parenting, and there can be a lot of negativity surrounded by this, and in the meantime, the child's not getting the help that they need so that they can be successful.
Do we find a lot of ADHDs in the schools today? You know, there's a lot of confusion with a lot of these kids. You see a tremendous amount of dropout rate and so on and so forth. And school is not what school used to be. Do you find a lot of the kids do you find that ADHD may be more prevalent in the schools today than it was years ago?
It absolutely is. In fact, when I started doing the ADHD research, that was 9 years ago, and at that time, 3% of the population had ADHD. Now, 9 years later, it's 10% So that's a 7% increase in only 9 years. That's fairly huge, considering that 20 years ago, it really wasn't even heard of. So it's very concerning the rate at which it is increasing.
Now, and by the way, if there is a structure, a process to deal with the kids, I remember years ago, I did an interview with somebody who was addressing ADHD, and he said it would have been different in the schools if you knew the kids had ADHD, a particular student, you know, restless and not concentrating and everything else that goes along with it. Instead of putting them at the desk to sit there, you stand them up at a desk, and all of a sudden they're engaged, they're working with it. And there's so many different things that you can do, because a lot of these kids are absolutely brilliant, but it's focusing that brilliance and that energy into something that's going to be constructive for them.
That is so true. And in fact, at our private school, we did just that. We found that ADHD kids, their mind isn't geared for the lecture, worksheet, regurgitate process that is done typically in the traditional school system. And so they have these incredible intelligences that they're not being able to access and utilize and share in a positive way because of the way that it's set up. And so we didn't have desks at our school, and most of the learning was done hand-on and where they were moving and alive and so excited about learning, where before they were in just total shutdown and in trouble. And so when we can meet the needs that they have and teach and reach in a way that works for them, that turns on their mind, incredible things can happen.
Well, absolutely. There's no question about that. And I think one of the major things that somebody with ADHD, not only kids, adults, it's the procrastination. Get them to sit down to do something. And once they've sat down, they're obsessed. I mean, they do it better than anybody else. But it's that sitting down. It's that getting focused, getting concentrated.
Well, it's also making it where it is interesting and or relevant to them. So, for instance, just doing rote math worksheets, that doesn't work with them. But if you have a store that they come up with, they have the money and they're doing the problems with that, or you have them create a trip that they're going to go on and they have to figure out all the expenses, those kinds of things, it engages them. And when they're engaged, their mind is, and then their behavior and productivity is incredible.
Now, by the way, one of the things that we've heard for years and years and years, started out with medicate them. Then then it was activated to don't medicate them. You know, give them enough, but don't just get them quiet and stick them in a corner someplace. Do those kids need medication, or are there some that really do, a percentage that do, and medication could be given in degrees?
Well, what I have found is there are many options other than medication that work as effective or better than medication without any side effects. And so that's one of the things that I offer, is options for parents other than medication, because they have so many negative side effects, especially physically. And with the other approach, you're addressing the actual contributors to the ADHD characteristics. And so the child's in a better position to function and be healthy than they would otherwise.
Okay, so in essence, you really have to know what you're doing with an ADHD kid. Now, have we found what causes this? Is it a genetic thing? Is it a disconnect? Is it a brain chemical imbalance? What have you found that's going to be the closest to it?
Well, what I have found is there is a genetic predisposition for it. So, for instance, just like with cancer, there can be that genetic predisposition. But there are a lot of factors that play into it. So it can be one of the big contributors is just the toxins and poisons that we have in our environment, the pesticides, the preservatives, all of these things that are in our food that go into the system. And when these things that aren't natural and don't belong in the body hit the brain, it really can mess up the chemical balance and the functioning of the brain, the neurotransmitters, all of these things. And so that is an issue that has to be addressed. Heavy metal toxicity, if kids don't have the right level of neurotransmitters in the brain, and that's a big one that I see, that has to be addressed. And so there are actually about 70 different contributors that can intensify the ADHD characteristics. And so if you address those, and typically you can start at the top of the spectrum and those that are the most common, and we start with that and then go down the list to help these kids so that they can have the success that they deserve.
Now, by the way, the kids themselves, once they realize the diagnosis is there, once they know that there is a problem and it's inherent, it's within them, is there a change? Is this really the first step for them coming back to whatever normal is?
Well, it's very important. A lot of parents are hesitant. They say, I don't want to have my child labeled as ADHD. And what the parents have to understand is ADHD is not who their child is. It is a set of conditions that their child has. And until you accept that reality, and the child accepts that, and says, this is something I have, just as if they had had diabetes and there were certain adaptations and things they had to do for that, there are certain things and adaptations they have to do because of the ADHD, and it's the very first and most crucial steps for them to be able to turn that ADHD stress into success.
And now, by the way, if I was a parent of a child with ADHD today, I would be more than happy to label my kid ADHD, because then I would have a handle on what it is. If I know what it is, I can work on it. Most people work on a problem that they don't have, and they never get anywhere. But if you know what the problem is, you work on the problem that you do have, and you can get someplace. Give me a label, but give me a label that has authenticity to it, and allow me to have the tools to be able to work through it, and I'm yours.
Right. And one of the things that I do also is to help parents understand that I divide ADHD into two categories. The first is functional, which that's where you make a few tweaks here and there, do some adaptations, get some organizational skills, and you get through life not only fine but actually quite well. The other is the problematic, and those that are the children that have extreme ADHD characteristics and multiple characteristics, they're the ones that fall into the statistics of the dropout rate, problems with relationships, with the law, with drugs, with all of these things. And so when we look at what needs to be done, we look at which category they fall under, and then there's a specific formula that needs to be followed to help them to be able to achieve the capabilities that they have.
Jedu, we're starting to run out of time now. Two things. One is we go to your website, which is www.answersaboutkids.com. And if you can see my picture on there, at the bottom, right at the bottom of the website, you'll see it. You click on that, and there's going to be a 15-minute free consultation, which I think is an absolutely great thing. Jedra Heimer, thank you so much for joining us. I think you're doing a great job, and there should be more people like you out there.
Thank you so much.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As friends, your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls.